It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with comedian and PC guy, John Hodgman. He's coming to Madison this weekend for a comedy show at the Barrymore.
But first, well, it's day three of the government shutdown, and American media organizations are all over the story. But our next guest says that coverage is missing the mark. Joining us now to talk about that is Dan Frumkin. He is the executive editor of fearlessmedia.org. And we've got a link to his piece, Shutdown Coverage Fails Americans, on the Central Time Facebook page. So check it out there. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. And from Eastern Time, I say hello.
We say hello back. So let's talk a bit. You start your piece out with just going through some coverage of the way American news organizations have been framing this story. For our listeners who may not have read that, how have American news organizations been framing this story so far?
Well, a lot of the news coverage is very process-oriented and says no agreements, gridlocks, both sides digging in their heels, back and forth, legislative back and forth, all of which is technically accurate. And they do have to cover the latest back and forth. But what's missing from these stories, and especially from the headlines, is the fact that this is a manufactured crisis from the very beginning, that this is the result of aberrational behavior by one party, in this case the Republican Party. It's an unprecedented attempt to hold the government hostage in return for legislative givebacks. There is no equivalency here in the bigger picture. So by writing about sort of the back and forth and saying Congress is failing to do this, I think people are being given a very false sense of what is actually causally responsible for this crisis.
And so if that is missing, why is that coverage missing?
Well, it's hard. It's hard for journalists to take sides, because that's ultimately sort of what you'd have to do here, right? You'd have to say, basically, the Democrats are saying this, the Republicans are saying that, and in this case, the Democrats are actually pretty much correct. That's a hard thing to do. So there are other ways to do it. it's funny. You can just sort of describe how it happened instead of doing the he said, she said reporting. For decades now, media critics have been pointing out that political journalists in particular succumb to this sort of false equivalence myth, this the sense that the only way you can be impartial and objective is by splitting the difference between the two sides. And we are in an unusual period right now where I think objectively, I think if you look at the course of history, the Republican Party is taking some very extreme and radical action. And if reporters try to sort of continue to follow the middle path between the two parties, they're being led into an extreme direction, and that direction is not actually adequately informing the public about what's going on.
And, part of that, though, if you are involved in journalism at all, that whole idea of balance, that whole idea of trying to be neutral and objective and all of that is something that's sort of written into your DNA, or at least, they talk about it a lot in journalism school, and they try to practice it a lot when you're writing or working in a broadcast situation or whatever it might be.
How, and it's part of the oxygen in the newsroom, too,
yeah.
And your editor is expected of you, and if you don't do it, it seems strange.
So what I'm getting at then is, given all of that, it's part of the oxygen, you're breathing it every single day, how do you get past that? How do you move on to something more what you're looking for, where you say that we need to, it sounds like, take sides to a certain extent?
Well, it's a question of being fearless, which is why I'm calling my new website fearlessmedia.org. The idea is you have to not be afraid of being criticized, and you have to remember what you're actually a journalist for, why you became a journalist in the first place, which is not to sort of triangulate your way through the day, but to hold the powerful accountable, to give the public the information it needs to be an informed electorate, to give it the information it needs to hold the powerful accountable. What's happening now is, by following this sort of chimera of objectivity, we're actually not holding people accountable for their actions. And it's become sort of a vicious cycle where if people, if politicians of either party say anything, say crazy things, and it works for them, and they don't get called out, they don't get exposed as being extremist, then they do it more and more. You know, so I think journalists just need to say, look, this is, you know, we have two rules here. One is we try to be fair, and the other is we try to actually tell the public what it needs to know. In this case, they're coming into conflict a little bit.
So do you have some examples of media that, in your estimation, are getting it right, that are covering the story in the right way, a place that we could look and get an example of what you're talking about?
Well, you know, in the article, the column that I wrote that ran on Al Jazeera, I cited the Guardian, which just basically said at the very top of the story, here's what they, how they put it. They said Republicans staged a series of last-ditch efforts to use a once routine budget procedure to force Democrats to abandon their efforts to extend U.S. health insurance. You don't need to be hyperbolic. You just need to say this is, but you know, this came about because Republicans took a procedure that is not in and of itself that controversial and turned it into a crisis.
And so, and as you read that, it doesn't really sound, you know, like a journalist taking sides.
No, no, it isn't actually a journalist taking sides. It's I'll leave it for the opinion writers and the partisans to say, blame the Republicans or blame the Democrats or that sort of stuff. But what's important is just to explain how we got here so that people can understand what happened. And what's astonishing is reading through these long stories written by, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, AP, Reuters, telling you all the back and forth that happened yesterday, all of which is basically, as one of my favorite bloggers calls it, covering the freak show. And it's not telling you what you need to know, which is how we got here, which is that this is a manufactured crisis. It's all covering, oh, my God, crisis, 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 and forgetting the fact that this is a manufactured one.
And I want to talk a little bit kind of about the state of journalism from a business perspective lately, because I wonder how that impacts in all this. You know, we've heard about the demise of newspapers. We see what's happening to network television news. We see all sorts of changes going on within journalism, and a lot of it related to the business side of things. Has that had an impact?
I think it has. I think in a lot of cases it's made people even more afraid to say anything that would subject you to criticism or lose readership or what have you. And I think that's actually the absolute wrong approach to take. I think it should make you less afraid and should make you realize that people aren't that interested in reading stenography and voiceless, unintelligible stuff. I think the value that journalists actually provide is to put stuff in context, is to explain it, is to help people understand who's telling the truth and who's not, rather than just sort of, you know, quoting them. So on the one hand, the danger is that people will be afraid to do the kind of journalism that they should. The good news, though, is I think actually the business model is stronger for journalism that has a traditional voice, speaking on behalf of its community, advocating for, you know, for the public, for the little guy, and speaking truth to power.
One more question. We're going to be taking a break in a second and getting to some phone calls.
Great.
One of the other things that has changed as I've been watching this over the years is that whole idea of sort of PR spin and sort of the proliferation of journalism-like press releases and journalism-like releases that wind up all over the place, that PR aspect, that selling stories to the media seems to have really changed as well.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it also encourages people to sort of create their own reality, because especially if they're writing their own news stories, they can say whatever they want.
But the journalists take them and run them.
That's a shame. They shouldn't do that.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking with Dan Frumkin about media coverage of the government shutdown as it's working its way into its third day. And we'd like to hear from you, too. Do you think the media is failing the American public when it comes to covering the shutdown, or failing the American public in general? Would you like to see journalists hold politicians more accountable for their actions? We'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. And we'll be taking those calls right after this break. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're continuing our conversation with Dan Frumkin from fearlessmedia.org about media coverage of the federal government shutdown. And you can join us, too. Would you like to see journalists hold politicians more accountable for their actions? Give us a call if you'd like to join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dan Frumkin, before we get to calls, one question I have for you is, where's the public in all this? Wouldn't you think they would be demanding something more of journalism?
That's a great question. When you hear the voices of the public, they're saying, you know, fix Congress, fix Washington. I think that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy here that we've sort of dumbed down the press coverage so much that people don't even ask for what they need. That said, this article I wrote, for instance, really touched the nerve. It's gotten like 120,000 Facebook likes, you know, since I ran the other morning. There is a hunger for this. There's just not a, I don't think there's a voice for advocacy for this kind of journalism, which is why I'm starting up my new nonprofit to do just that. So I do think there's a hunger in the public. I think that what you hear back from the public right now is sort of a generic dislike of a lot of things because we're not differentiating enough.
We have a posting on Facebook. It's sort of long. It's from Jerry, and I think he might share that hunger with you. He says, most popular media seems unable to get beyond their mental model that all problems have just two sides. Media provides little information to provide context to today's events. The people responsible for the shutdown are the people who ran for Congress with a conviction that government isn't necessary. He winds up asking, why does it take Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert to call out the talking points for what they are? What do you think about that?
Boy, you know, I'll tell you, Stewart and Colbert have just walked, you know, really filled a vacuum that I think was created precisely by the kind of journalism that I'm complaining about. They don't worry about being, you know, about both sides. They just call, you know, baloney. And this calling of baloney, I think, is absolutely what people look to journalists for. They're not finding it there, so they're getting it from the comedians.
So does that make them a journalist?
You know, the who is a journalist thing, that's a tough one. I think in this day and age, you can't answer that question anymore. Who's doing journalism? I think they're doing a tremendous service in terms of informing the public. Absolutely.
Let's go to the phones right now and find out what listeners have to say. We've got a call from Charlie, who joins us in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A very interesting topic, and I find it very interesting because I try very hard to see both sides and to obtain news from both sides, both in the newsprint as well as on TV. The one thing I would say is that I do think that all journalism is selectively choosing what topics to cover. Example, in George Bush's term, Valerie Plame and the Scooter Libby scandal. That needed to be covered. Some people covered it tough and some did not, but that needed to be covered. Conversely, if you look now, the Lois Lerner and the IRS, that is not being covered except by Fox News. Yet that is a story that I do believe needs to be covered. And when we talk about the shutdown, again, we are not getting at the main thing, which is that Obamacare is a new entitlement that will cost money. And in a country that has an increasing debt where we're spending more than we take in, this will add to the deficit. And it needs to be handled somehow, either through discretionary cuts or increased taxes. And nobody is saying that except Fox News again. So,
Charlie, thanks so much for those calls and those thinking. Dan Frumkin, when you hear callers like Charlie who says that there is coverage of some of these stories and has some very definite opinions about these, you know, how do you convince a listener like Charlie that there's more to the news than what he is reading?
Well, I mean, first of all, Charlie is absolutely right that all news is selective. I mean, there is no such thing as true objectivity. You make a ton of decisions about what's an important story, what's not, how to write it, how not to. The question is, are you making the decision because you're sort of intelligently assessing what the facts are, or because you're chasing after some you know, sort of sense of triangulation between what one person is saying and what another person is saying? Because I think that a lot of journalists are very smart people, and they should use their brains rather than sort of chase after some mean between two statements. I think that that if you get a lot of intelligent, non-ideological people in a room together in Washington, they'll agree on a lot of stuff on the facts. Once you have the facts established, you can have a really wonderful argument. I think Obamacare is a perfect example of an issue with a lot of really significant, interesting possible philosophical disagreements. I would say, however, that this is not the time to be arguing them because you need to keep the government open. But the other problem is making sure that people do have those shared facts. And that's where, you know, Charlie's mentioning of Fox News worries me, because I think Fox News operates in a largely not fact-free, but sort of making, you know, fact-free zone. They make up their own facts a lot of the time. You know, Obamacare, for instance, you know, by some measures is going to reduce costs. That said, I think that Charlie is exactly right. We should have reasonable discussions on how do you pay for government.
David is with us now from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yes, another thing I don't like is six corporations owning 90% of the media in the world. I mean, it's just, if I had my way, I would break these down to size. And as far as election campaign, not until you fix the media. NPR is one of the bright spots in the whole media thing, but you still, I mean, it's just like, I agree with your guest 100%. You quit being this as all treating whatever the Republicans say and the Democrats say is equal. I mean, or what the climate scientists and climate skeptics. No, there are opinions and there are facts, and the facts have to take precedence.
That's a good place to leave it there. What about that, Dan? What about corporate ownership of media?
Well, I think there's no coincidence that media consolidation and sort of a flattened voice have gone hand in hand. I think if you go into newsrooms today, they feel more sort of corporate and buttoned down than they did even just, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I think it's not a coincidence. I think that I don't think it's anything like that. You know, the corporate hegemons are telling the reporters how to write, but I do think there is such a thing as corporate culture, and I think it does leach through, and it does sort of create an environment in the newsroom where people are afraid to go out on a limb.
Well, let me ask you this then: given all of that, given what we've talked about, where are these brave journalists of the future going to come from?
You know, I actually think they're there already. I think, you know, I've spent much of the last 10 years writing sort of an iconoclastic stories in one medium or another about Washington press coverage. But I also know the people who write this stuff, and they're smart and they're skeptical. And I think they're captives of a culture and of an editorial process that is forcing them to sort of check their brains at the door sometimes. So I I'm very optimistic. I feel like things are so bad in the news business that we're at a potential inflection point where we say, you know what, maybe we're doing something wrong here. Maybe we need to change course. And, you know, for me, that moment would have come a couple of years after the war in Iraq, when that poll came out showing 70% of Americans thought Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. If you're an American newsroom executive at that point, you ought to sit there and go, okay, we're doing something wrong. We have failed. And there's unfortunately a lot of cases since then to show that we're not succeeding at informing the electorate. We're not succeeding with our business models. Maybe we need to change. Maybe we need to put in a little, change our oxygen suppliers.
And if we don't change?
If we don't change it, I think we'll become more and more marginalized, and I think the country will be the worse off for it. I think you know, the good news is there are a lot of new independent voices of journalism, but some of this stuff takes a lot of money. So I mean, it's great there's a lot of philanthropy money behind investigative reporting and so on. But no, I think it's scary. I think newsrooms and newspapers are a terrific institution to do this, to carry these traditions forward. And I'm worried that they will either dumb themselves down or go out of business.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Frumkin is executive editor of fearlessmedia.org, and we've got a link to that piece we've been talking about, Shutdown Coverage Fails Americans, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, a conversation with comedian, author, and Daily Show resident expert John Hodgman. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickard. Our next guest has been a nerdy, mustachioed personal computer on TV in a series of commercials for Apple.
He's also been a deranged millionaire informing the masses about roving super PACs of dogs and why we should be hoarding mayonnaise in the lead up to the Mayan apocalypse, which didn't happen.
I've still got a lot of mayonnaise at home, though. He is comedian John Hodgman, a regular on The Daily Show. Rob and Veronica talked to him earlier this week.
John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I am in Eastern Time, your future.
That's right. Whoa.
What's happening there in the future?
Well, as you know, I just turned 40, and I think I will continue to just turn 40 for the next several years.
Sounds a good plan.
I actually just turned 42. Can you believe it? Time is passing, even here in Eastern Time.
Oy.
Well, the good news there is that time is still passing. When you turn 40, you started worrying about apocalypses, especially the Mayan kind. Why did that grab you?
Well, I've always been fascinated with apocalypse visions, particularly in popular culture, Mad Max and the Omega Man, and sort of post-apocalyptic dystopias. That's the sort of thing that intrigues a narcissistic child, which I was for many, many years, because the best thing about those post-apocalyptic stories is that there's always one survivor, and it is told from that person's point of view, so it makes you feel essential and smart. But then, once you turn 40, you start thinking about apocalypse in a slightly different way. You start thinking of it in a kind of a comforting way, because you realize that we're all going to face our own mini-apocalypse eventually. And the nice thing about a world-shattering apocalypse is that if I have to go, I get to take the rest of the universe out with me. And that reassures me that I'm important and central to culture.
Well, of course, the Mayan apocalypse didn't happen. How surprised
were you? Notice?
I did notice. You know, if the Seventh-day Adventists had their great disappointment, was that the same thing for you?
You're speaking of the Millerites in the 19th century who became the Seventh-day Adventists. They went up to the tops of the mountains in upstate New York wearing their white robes, and they waited for the end to come. And it didn't come, and it was called the Great Disappointment. Isn't that wonderful? They all had to go back down to their homes where they were made fun of, and they had given away all their possessions. Now, luckily, none of my followers went to such great lengths, even though I encouraged them to. They figured out before I did that it was probably a mistake to base my doomsday predictions on an ancient civilization, the Mayans, that couldn't even figure out how to make smooth pyramids. And so December 21st... came and passed into December 22nd, and it turned out the world didn't end. It's just continuing to end in the same dumb, slow way. And so I'm trying to discover what next to do with this unexpected chapter of my life that I did not think I would ever have.
Well, you celebrated / marked / dreaded the apocalypse with an event you called Ragnarok, kind of mixing cultures from the opposite side of the globe. What happened on your own personal Ragnarok night?
Well, I went down to the Bell House, which is a comedy and music venue here in Brooklyn where I live, and I welcomed my few remaining followers to await the end, and we had documentary footage that we took that we planned to copy down to a thumb drive and send out into space for whatever civilizations remained, but It turned out the world didn't end, so we put it on Netflix.
Let me throw this at you, John. What if the world did end? And we're just imagining this. It's the Pincher Martin occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge scenario. We've been dead all this time.
I see what you're saying. I would be sad, though. I would be sad if this conversation were just a limbo dream.
That you couldn't do better? Or?
Yeah, well, I would like to come see Madison again. I had a really good time there with my friend Bill Corbett in 2012. I'd never been before, and it's a great town.
You've never been to Madison before?
I had never been to Madison before that one time, and now I want to make it a two-time visit.
Well, let me advise you to eat cheese curds.
Yeah, no problem. I got that covered already.
And what else?
You can't see me right now, but I'm standing in a tub of fried cheese curds right now. This is my new skin treatment.
Excellent. Preparing for the Madison visit already. That's good news.
Yeah, well, I have to make myself more useful now that I'm actually going to go ahead and get older and the world didn't die. I've started twirling my mustache up in a hipsterish fashion and wearing jeans more often in order to regain the youth that I thought was lost to me.
I was going to ask you about that mustache. That seems to be one silver lining that came out of the failed apocalypse. You have a mustache.
Are you talking about the three single silver gray strands of hair in my mustache? One of the many reasons my mustache is so uncanny and unnerving to people. I am a 42-year-old man who's got mousy brown hair that has not a single gray hair in it because of some weird reverse curse of some kind. And then my mustache is deep midnight black with streaks of silver in it. And people think that I'm either wearing false hair or a false mustache. But no, they're both of the same person. The duality of me is childlike hair and creepy dark mustache.
Man, this 40 thing is hitting you pretty heavy. I was, coming up to 40 X number of years ago. I was a little worried about it. I got through it, no problem.
I don't think you did.
No? I've been dead all along.
You keep turning it around to you.
So I'm just projecting my 40-ness onto
you.
No,
he's always been a narcissist.
The narcissism of the mid-lifer.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I could have told you that.
Yeah, right? I'm right about him, right?
Mm,
right
you are, dead on.
Yeah, totally.
I'll ask the questions here. this isn't about me. It isn't.
Or is it?
Mm.
Well, it's all about us. Just the three of us right now in this moment. Go. Question.
So GQ said one of the things that you are doing to deal with your post-non-apocalypse life and turning 40 and all of that stuff is that you are wearing fancy sneakers. You're wearing Saucony sneakers. Does that help?
Yes, it does, because first of all, I don't get any money for this, but they are wonderful sneakers, not too expensive, fantastic arch support, and they come in a variety of colors, all of which make me seem more youthful and vibrant because I am still youthful and relevant to the world. But also, I'm changing my performing style. In a sense, I'm wearing sneakers on stage as well as off because my performing style is much less formal now. I still do some strange things on stage. I can't guarantee I won't wear a 1980s blue dress and speak in the channeled voice of Ayn Rand as though she were writing a magazine column for Parade in 1980, but I'm also just talking. My comedy, I would say, right now is much more straightforward as I've tried to figure out what it is I'm thinking about and care about in life. The stories have tended to be more personal and more observational about the strangeness that is my life here in Brooklyn.
How come? Why are you changing? Because you had this persona for a long time. You've had the kind of nerdy Apple guy, later with a mustache. You've had the Ayn Rand thing and the persona on The Daily Show. Why are you going personal now?
Listen, if I were a professional entertainer, I would have found my brand and stuck with it and not ruined it with a mustache. But the fact is that I feel compelled to challenge myself and figure out what it is that is preoccupying me at any given moment. I think that's what you have to do as whatever it is I am, a person who talks or writes or creates in any way. And so, unfortunately, I've ruined it for all of us by trying to tread new ground. And when you say, why do I do what I do now, the more personal material, well, it's honestly, I have no choice. I spent 6 years being a fake expert and then blowhard deranged millionaire, both of which were rather heightened versions of myself, and the apocalypse didn't come, and I can't use any of that material anymore, so by necessity I was forced to look around and see what I was thinking about now. And what I'm thinking about now is Ayn Rand and Downton Abbey and to some degree my children, the kinds of sneakers I want to wear. What else? Oh, cool clothes and where to get them. Surf shops, poop cruises. Can I say poop cruise on the radio? Well, I did.
You can, but we don't know what it is.
But you can't leave it at that.
You're not familiar with the... Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh. Well, here's the thing. Back in February, there was a ship called the Carnival Triumph that went out into the Gulf of Mexico and broke down.
Ah.
And went immediately, within 2 days, from normal society to pure Mad Max status. Like, people were sleeping on the decks, fighting with each other, not using the facilities properly. It just went to show how thin a veneer civilization is upon the chaos. And now here we are in the midst of a government shutdown. And I saw last night that Miley Cyrus was reading Juno Diaz on Twitter. So who's to say Ragnarok isn't happening after all? This does seem a little weird, doesn't it? Maybe it's just a little late.
So, John, we covered the poop cruises there. What else is occupying your attention in our post-non-apocalypse world?
Well, as I say, I'm fascinated with exploring a kind of personal comedy that I haven't really done much of. And that includes, to some degree, the acknowledgement in public that I am a married person who has human children. And for a long time, I kind of evaded that kind of personal comedy, in part because I wanted to protect the privacy of these non-public figures that I happen to live with. And equally because I kind of felt like this is something that everyone does. But it turns out everyone does it because it is universal. I still have some trouble talking frankly about my children because it does seem a little bit lazy to me because, let's face it, children are kind of dumb. And they say dumb things that are hilarious, and all you need to do is repeat them, and you've got comedy. So to avoid that problem, I do talk about my children in my act now, but I just pretend that I'm talking about my cats. So, for example, funny story, the other night I was watching Downton Abbey with my cats, and my younger cat couldn't understand what was going on, and my older cat was like, why don't you shut up until you're old enough to really watch Downton Abbey?
Those darn cats.
Cats say the darndest thing.
They never get the plot lines, do they?
No, exactly.
I want to ask you about an essay I read that's probably from a couple of years back. And it's about something you wrote about being an only child from a book of essays by only children. I'm an only child, so it was something I was thinking about and kind of moving through at the time. Yes.
We're both members of the Super Smart Narcissist Club. Hello.
The tiny tribe. I know. And
I feel left out now.
Sorry, Rob.
Yeah, well, you know what? It doesn't have to be about you, 40 years old.
Zing.
So, John, how do you think that being an only child shaped who you are?
Utterly profoundly, and I'll tell you exactly why. For the longest time, I would say, it was the greatest thing in the world. And why wouldn't it be? I had the loving attention, 100% attention of both of my parents. I lived in a wonderful neighborhood of Brookline, Massachusetts, where we had enough room in our house for me to not only have one but two rooms, plus a private bathroom. I converted the second room into a kind of a living room slash lounge. I broke apart my old bunk bed that I had, because all only children need bunk beds in order to really highlight the gap in this part of their lives. And I broke apart the bunk bed into two different sort of like lounging sofas, and I bought a fern and a brass lamp, and I got my parents' old black and white TV out, and I set up a really nice sort of bachelor pad for myself at the age of 13 or whatever, and I would sit there of an evening and watch Dick Clark and Ed McMahon do bloopers on television and just think I was the most sophisticate of sophisticates. And that's what being an only child was. I realize now that wasn't normal at all. I spent my entire teenage years, well into my 20s, imagining how great it would be when I was 35, largely to evade all kinds of sexual anxiety. And then I hit 35, and wouldn't you know it, it was honestly among the greatest years of my life. I had become married. I had human children. Everyone was healthy and happy. I got a job on The Daily Show. I got a job making ads for Apple Computer, which were the delight of my life. And I was like, yeah, I was right to wish for 35. But then time didn't stop. And the Apple ads went away, I guess because we sold all the computers, because why else would they do a terrible thing like that to me? And then I got older and I got to be 42, and I realized that I had spent my entire only childhood dreaming of being a grown-up, and now that I truly am a grown-up, I wish I had that time back to be a kid. And to me, that translates into wearing yellow sneakers that announce to the world, I'm not dying, I'm still
Well, there's been a movement lately that is largely, I think, driven by only children themselves. Some of them are scholars, some of them are social commentators, writers, who say, kind of back off the only children people. We're not narcissistic. We're well-adjusted. I don't know, and it's something
incorrect.
Do you think that's true? I mean, do you agree with these people who are saying, back off, only children are okay?
Well, everybody is okay. I mean, you know, only children have a certain set of problems that are not shared by kids who have one, two, three, or more siblings, or kids from blended families, or what have you. It's just a different set of challenges and problems. The only problem with the only child is you don't recognize the problems as problems because your life is so good. You don't have anyone torturing you. You don't have anyone fighting for your parents' attention. You get all the toys. You get to go on vacation. When you're an only child, your parents aren't even your parents. They're like your older roommates who hang around because they can't, you know, it's like you come to rely on each other so much for sort of just company while you're watching PBS at night or whatever. And it doesn't feel like a problem until later on when you realize, oh, you'd had no one necessarily there to bother you and to fight for attention and to teach you how to have productive conflict. And one thing I think that's true about only children, and certainly true about me, is that, you know, if you're an only child, and particularly one who's never been involved at all in the ritualized conflict resolution that is sports, you become nervous about simple confrontations, such as asking for the bill in a restaurant or something. So that's something that I think I didn't even notice was a challenge for me until I was much older.
John, you mentioned you have kids, plural.
Was cats. That
a,
yeah. Two
cats.
Cats,
yeah. Sorry. Was it a conscious decision on your part to not replicate the only child experiment?
It was a conscious decision on my wife's part.
Ah. she didn't want him to turn out like you.
I had to be talked into it, or rather I didn't, because her judgment was clearly so great to begin with when we had our first child. She was right. That was a really good idea. And then when she said we should have another child, because she is one of three, I said, well, I'm going to have to go along with you, even though I know in my heart and every fiber of my body that what you're suggesting is impossible. To divide my love between two different small beings cannot be done. I'm going to like one of them and hate the other, and it's going to be a tragedy. But I guess I've discovered what most humans in history have discovered, that you actually can love two, three, four, or five different children at a time.
Crazy.
I know, it's crazy, right? But luckily, I am the one who finally discovered it.
Excellent. Well done. Well, you mentioned having trouble with conflict, and yet one of your side
gigs... Why are you beating up on me? Why are you doing this to me?
I'm sorry, man. I'll back off. No, one of your side gigs is judging...
Let me talk to the only child again. I'm only going to talk to the only child.
I'm here for you, John.
Well, I'm going to power through here. One of your side gigs is being a judge. You help other people resolve their conflicts. How did you get into that? Why did you want to start doing that?
Well, you're referring to my podcast, which is called Judge John Hodgman, which I co-host with my friend Jesse Thorne, who is also my producer at the Maximum Fun Network of podcasts. And it's something I've been doing for a couple of years. I hadn't really intended to do a podcast. I started it before every comedian in the world had a podcast. But Jesse had me on to resolve a couple of disputes on another show of his, and I enjoyed doing it because I enjoy telling people how to live and who's right and who's wrong. I also enjoyed having a chance to just speak in my own voice, not in the guise of a nerdy expert or as a monstrous deranged millionaire, but just as who I really am in life, and to bring a little bit of my own experience and personhood to bear in these. And it felt like a safe place to do it because I could do it kind of off stage, personally, in the intimate world of podcasting. So people would call in with their disputes over who does the dishes correctly, or how to load the laundry, or you know, whether or not to have a gun in the home, or is my husband's plan to take over the Walmart in case of a zombie apocalypse actually a reasonable plan? The answer is no. The guy did not. They made a lot of errors, but it just turned into an enormously fun way to express myself in a much more candid mode than I had before. In many ways, the way I'm talking to you now,
John. We just have about a minute left. Can you give us a little more idea of what people will see when they come to your show here in Madison in a few days?
Well, one thing I haven't mentioned and really should have right off the bat is that I will not be there alone. I will be joined by Bill Corbett, one of the great comic minds of our time. Bill was the second person to play Crow T. Robot on Mystery Science Theater 3000 and currently has an amazing venture called Riff Tracks with his former MST3K collaborators Mike Nelson and Kevin Murphy, where they record essentially MST3K style tracks to existing films that you can buy and play while watching the film. It's really funny. And Bill is also joining me on an adventure because he rarely performs solo. So Bill will come out and do some solo material. I will come out and perform comedy along the veins that I've described so far and also some surprises. And that will take, I guess, probably, let's see, 90 minutes of your time, more or less. And then I will come out to the lobby and I will happily greet and sign and say hello and have a drink with anyone who feels like hanging around. And then I'm going to go out into the night and find some cheese curds.
That sounds about a perfect night in Madison. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was a conversation from earlier this week. Veronica and I were talking to John Hodgman. He's a comedian, actor, author of More Information Than You Require, and an expert on The Daily Show. He's coming to Madison this Saturday, October 5th at the Barrymore.
So get your cheese curds while you can, because once he gets to town, it sounds as though there's going to be a shortage. Coming up, a biography of two people who changed the way we talk about sex in the United States.
Yeah, it's a biography called The Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. You were just saying off the air, Gene, that you don't have the cable.
I don't have the cable, and I don't have the satellite. I have the over-the-air.
Right. I have some cable. I don't have Showtime, but that new Showtime. There's a new Showtime series based on this biography. It's racy stuff. It's these people who research sex, and they had a pretty stormy, complicated personal life between the two of them, and a lot of controversy in the scientific community. We're going to talk to the author of this biography coming up. So it's going to be interesting.
It is going to be interesting. We'll have just a bit of the racy stuff and a lot of the interesting stuff coming up on Central Time.
You can find out more about what's coming up, join the conversations on our Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR. Don't forget, if you're on Twitter, you can follow us there, Central Time WPR. More to come. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.